As we've already heard from Ed Whitten, and as I'm sure we'll hear many times throughout this conference, there's been a revival of interest recently in anti-de-Sitter space, brought about largely by the Maldacena conjecture of a duality between supergravity theories in the bulk of the anti-de-Sitter space and superconformal theories on the boundary. I'm sure Dan Friedman is right when he tells us that anti-de-Sitter space is a nice place to visit, but you wouldn't want to live there. But it certainly seems to be the place where we're all spending our summer vacation. Now, the subject of anti-de-Sitter space, brains, singletons, superconformal field theories, was in fact an active area of research about 10 years ago. And so I'd like to begin my talk by giving a brief review of what was being done then and see to what extent it fits in with what we're doing now. And a recent paper by these authors also gives you some interesting historical insights. Then, assuming I haven't been given the red card, I'd like to tell you about some recent work in collaboration with Hong Liu and Chris Pope, where we focus in particular on the ADS5 cross S5 vacuum, which is conjectured to provide a duality between Yang-Mills theory and type 2B string theory. And we exploit the fact that a 5-sphere can be written as a U1 bundle over CP2. And we use that U1 isometry to do a T-duality that allows us to extend this duality to the 2A superstring and then to an 11-dimensional M-theoretic description. And an interesting byproduct of that will be a phenomenon that we call BPS without BPS. So let's go back to the early 80s. At that time, there was great interest in gauging the N-extended supergravity theories. The N-extended supergravity theories have a global SON symmetry, and the question was raised, can we elevate that global SON to a local SON? And it was shown by Das and Friedman, one can do that, but we pay a price in that the theory acquires a cosmological constant, lambda, and Newton's constant times lambda is given by minus the gauge coupling constant associated with this local SON. In that case, therefore, the underlying symmetry of these theories is no longer Poincaré supersymmetry, but rather anti-de-Sitter supersymmetry. Now, this suggested that these gauged extended supergravity theories might have a Kaluza-Klein interpretation, because in Kaluza-Klein theories, we have a local gauge group whose coupling constant E is given by E squared is Gm squared, where M is the inverse size of this compact space. And one also typically finds in such compactifications a cosmological constant given by minus M squared. So if you put these two things together, you get an equation that looks like the gauged extended supergravity theory. And indeed, one can show that this is true. In particular, the maximal N equal 8 SO8 supergravity theory of DeWitt and Nicolai was seen to be just the massless sector of 11-dimensional supergravity compactified on 4-dimensional anti-de-Sitter space times a 7-sphere. Now, one feature of these compactifications that I think was insufficiently stressed in earlier Kaluza-Klein literature is that the compactification is spontaneous in the sense that the vacuum is a solution of the higher dimensional field equations. It's not put in by hand, but corresponds to solving the higher dimensional field equations. And the spontaneous compactification mechanism appropriate to this ADS4 cross S7 was the so-called Freund-Rubin mechanism, where we give a non-zero vacuum expectation value to the four-form field strength of 11-dimensional supergravity in the 0, 1, 2, 3 directions. So that naturally splits the space-time into 4 plus 7, and it gives rise to the ADS4 cross S7 vacuum. Now, the moment one introduces anti-de Sitter space, people naturally started thinking about singletons. Now, singletons are these strange representations of the anti-de Sitter group, which were first discussed by Dirac in the early 60s and much studied by Franz Dahler and his collaborators. The anti-de Sitter group in four dimensions is SO32, and we need two quantum numbers to label the representations, E0, which is the lowest energy eigenvalue, and the angular momentum, or spin, S. Unitarity places some inequalities on these quantum numbers, and it's useful to split the representations into three different groups. And the ones where E0 is a half and S equals zero, or E0 equals one and S is a half, are the so-called singleton representations. And what's interesting about them is that they have no Poincaré analog. If we take the lambda going to zero limit to recover the Poincaré theory, then the massless representations and the massive ones have Poincaré limits, but the singleton representations have no Minkowskian analog, and that's what makes them interesting. And one can generalize this to the supersymmetric anti-de Sitter group, and you can extend it to extended supersymmetries, as was shown by Friedman and Nicolai, and one finds all the usual phenomena of multiplet shortening and other things that we're used to in Poincaré supersymmetry. Now, in addition to the giving a vacuum expectation value to the four form of 11-dimensional supergravity to give you ADS4 times S7, one could also imagine doing the same thing to the 7-dimensional dual field strength and getting a compactification of ADS7 cross S4. And similarly, one can play the same trick in type 2b supergravity, where one has a self-dual 5-index field strength. And in that case, the maximally symmetric vacuum is ADS5 cross S5. So the bosonic symmetries in these three cases are SO32 cross SO8, SO42 cross SO6, SO62 cross SO5. But it also turns out that these are maximally symmetric in the supersymmetric sense. And so the symmetry of these vacua is a supergroup. And in these three cases, the supergroups go by the name of OSP48, SU2,24, and OSP6,24. Now, these supergroups are interesting in that they admit the singleton representations. This one, the ADS4 cross S7, will admit the singletons I've just been talking about, suitably generalized to n equals 8. But as discussed by Gunaydin and others, the other two cases also admit singleton representations. And here I've called them doubletons and tripletons just to distinguish between them, although this is not the conventional terminology, I should warn you. But as Ed has stressed a few minutes ago, these supergroups have a dual interpretation. They're the anti-de Sitter groups in the bulk, but they're also the superconformal groups in one dimension less, appropriate to the boundary of the anti-de Sitter space. And as was stressed by Franz Dahl and others, these singletons have the interesting interpretation that they are best thought of as living not in the bulk of the space-time, but rather on the boundary of the anti-de Sitter space. So in the case of the singletons, we have a three-dimensional n equal 8 superconformal theory with 8 scalars and 8 spinners living on the boundary. In the case of S5, we have an n equal 4, d equal 4 vector theory living on the boundary. And in the case of S4, the six-dimensional boundary is described by this tensor multiplet. Now, one way of seeing why the singletons are best thought of living on the boundary can be found in some earlier papers by Flatow Fromsdahl. Let me just take the scalar field as an example. Let's suppose we have a scalar field capital Phi that lives in the bulk of the anti-de Sitter space and is described by an action Phi minus box plus m squared Phi. And the space we're integrating over is the anti-de Sitter space that looks like this, where A is the constant that determines the curvature of the anti-de Sitter space. Now, the singleton field is distinguished by having a very particular value of m squared, which turns out to be 5 over 4 a squared. And in that case, some interesting things happen. One can show that for, and this is in the paper of Flatow and Fromsdahl, for example, that the field falls off at infinity, like r to the minus 1/2, and that as a result of this fall off, one can rewrite the four-dimensional action as an action on the boundary of the anti-de Sitter space, which has a topology S1 cross S2. So the S1 cross S2 boundary is given by the coordinates t, theta, and phi. The r dependence has all disappeared, and we've got this superconformal theory living on the boundary. Now, one can generalize this to the n equal 8 case. Let's look again at the ADS4 cross S7 example. And this is something that I did with my graduate student, Miles Blenko. And we looked at the OSP48 singletons that live on the S1 cross S2 boundary of the four-dimensional anti-de Sitter space. And you see it's described by a theory with 8 scalars and 8 spinners. It has n equal 8 supersymmetry, and it lives on an S1 cross S2 manifold with signature minus plus plus. And as the singletons should, it's a superconformal theory where OSP48 is the superconformal group. Now, if you look at this theory for a few minutes, you notice it has some interesting properties. There are 8 bosons, 8 fermions, 8 supersymmetries, 3 dimensions, signature minus plus plus. Now, there's another theory that has all those properties, and that's the theory you get by taking the 11-dimensional supermembrane of Birgsoff, Sesgen, and Townsend that had just been discovered, going to a physical gauge. You again get a theory that's described by 8 scalars, 8 spinners, n equal 8 supersymmetries, 3 dimensions, and has signature minus plus plus. So I suggested that there might be a connection between the super singletons and the super p-brains. Let's just remind ourselves how the counting of degrees of freedom works. For these supermembranes, one starts with a Green-Schwarz formalism with superspace coordinates x and theta. You can go to a physical gauge, which means that in a space-time of dimension capital D and world-volume dimension little d, the number of bosonic degrees of freedom is given by the transverse dimensions big D minus little d. To get the number of fermionic degrees of freedom, you take the dimension of a minimal spinner that I've called capital M, which will be different in different dimensions. You multiply it by the number of supersymmetries, capital N. You divide it by 2, because these Green-Schwarz actions have a kappa symmetry that eliminates half the fermionic degrees of freedom. And then you divide by 2 again to go on shell. And so these theories, since they're supersymmetric, must be such that the number of bosons equals the number of fermions. And the example I've just given you, therefore, is one where big D equals 11, little d equals 3, so there are 8 bosons, and similarly, there's one supersymmetry, 32 components, and if you divide by 4, you get 8. Now, this connection, or suggested connection, between supermembranes and supersingletons is strengthened by a solution of the coupled 11-dimensional supergravity supermembrane field equations that was found by Birgsoff, Pope, Sezgin, and myself. And we called this solution the membrane at the end of the universe, because it described a configuration in which the space-time is four-dimensional anti-de Sitter space times a 7 sphere, and one in which the membrane occupies the S1 cross S2 boundary of the ADS4 space. So this has kind of holographic overtones, and I think it would be very interesting to try and explore to what extent these ideas of membranes at the end of the universe are compatible with the recent ideas on duality. Here's some of the authors that were involved in those early supersingleton, supermembrane equivalence papers. Now, if it works for the membrane in 11 dimensions, you might ask, does it also work for the other brains? Now, at that time, in 1988, we only knew about the brains that had, whose whirl volume fields were described by scalar supermultiplets. So let's focus on those for a moment. There were 12 of them, which fall into four sequences that have the Green-Schwarz superstrings in 3, 4, 6, and 10 as their limiting cases. So these were the 12 supermembranes that were known at the time. I plotted the whirl volume dimension horizontally and the space-time dimension vertically. And sure enough, if you look up Nam's 78 paper to find out which superconformal groups admit supersingleton representations that fall into scalar multiplets, you find the answer is also 12. And what you find indeed is that there's a one-to-one correspondence between the brains and the supergroups that admit singletons in scalar supermultiplets. So those 12 points on the brain scan just correspond to these 12 supergroups. Now, an interesting thing happened, which at the time puzzled us, which it was understood a couple of years later, but which at the time was a puzzle. These are just the singletons in scalar supermultiplets, because at the time, those were the only brains that we knew about. But one could look a little further. Let's take n equal 4 in this case, or n equal 4 in this case. And these corresponded to the doubleton or tripleton representations, which are described not by scalar supermultiplets, but by vector or tensor supermultiplets. So one should have been able to say, unfortunately it wasn't said, one should have been able to say already in 1988 that there are more brains on the scan than scalar supermultiplets. Here are the three brains, the three singleton, tripleton, and doubleton representations. We should have been able to say that there's also a five brain in 11 dimensions, and the membrane at the end of the universe is described by the tripletons, and there's also a three brain in 10 dimensions, where the membrane at the end of the universe is described by the n equal 4, d equal 4 gauge theory. But because we didn't know the brains at that time, the correspondence appeared to break down. Well, of course, a couple of years later, it was realized that there is a five brain in 11 dimensions. The soliton was discovered by Gouvain. And as Gibbons and Townsend pointed out, the world volume fields on Gouvain's five brain are indeed just the six-dimensional tensor multiplet, which is in turn just the tripleton of OSP 6,24. And similarly, after Horowitz and Strominger had discovered the self-dual black three-brain, Lou and I pointed out that in the extreme limit, it corresponds to a super three-brain whose world volume fields are given by a d equal 4, n equal 4 gauge theory, which is just the doubleton of SU2,24. Now, I should stress there was one important ingredient that was not appreciated in the old days, and that was the fact that we can interpret these three brains as Dirichlet brains, and that if you take n coincident Dirichlet brains, you get a non-abelian SUN theory. I'd better speed up because I don't want to be disqualified from the next round. Well, more recently, of course, there's another way in which anti-de Sitter space has entered the game. That's in these near-horizon geometries. I've given the three-brain as an example. If we take the r going to zero limit of the three-brain, which is equivalent to the n going to infinity limit for n three-brains, the geometry goes over into ADS5 cos S5, and similar remarks apply for the ADS4 cross S7 and ADS7 cross S4. On the other hand, for generic brains, this is not true. What typically happens is that the gradient of the dilaton is a conformal Killing vector on the ADS, and that spoils the superconformal symmetry. So in this respect, you have what you might call a p-brain aristocracy. The 11-dimensional membrane, the 11-dimensional 5-brain, and the type 2b self-dual 3-brain are special in that respect. Is my time up? How much do I have? Okay. Well, let's zip now then to the present day. We know that 2b string theory in ADS5 plus S5 is seemingly dual to an n equal 4, d equal 4 SUN Yang-Mills theory. And there are relations between the conformal field theory on the boundary and the supergravity theory in the bulk. Well, let me just state, without going through the details, that if we take that ADS5 cross S5 example, you can rewrite the 5-sphere as a U1 bundle over CP2, where the Kaluza-Klein vector potential A is the Kähler form on the CP2. And we can use that U1 to perform a T-duality, which takes the type 2B string on ADS5 cross S5 to a type 2A string. And an interesting phenomenon is that that T-duality untwists the product, the CP2 cross S1. So you now have a direct product. And that's why we call it ADS5 cross S5 untwisted. And having rewritten everything in terms of a 2A theory, one can then go one step further and write it in terms of an M theory on ADS5 cross CP2 cross T2. I don't have time to tell you about the properties of that, but let me just mention that it exhibits a phenomenon that we call supersymmetry without supersymmetry, because if you look at the type 2A supergravity theory, it appears to have a much smaller bosonic group and a much smaller number of supersymmetries, namely zero, than the 2B theory we started with. Now, if we believe that the 2A string is dual to the 2B string, the symmetry should be SO6 and N equals 8. But if you look just at the 2A supergravity theory, you find it's only SU3 cross U1 and N equals 0. And the explanation for that is that the supergravity theory is deficient in one important respect. It ignores the winding modes. The supergravity theory correctly incorporates the Kaluza-Klein modes, but it does not correctly incorporate the winding modes. And when the winding modes are correctly reinstored, you see that what you thought was not a supersymmetric vacuum is actually supersymmetric. And in fact, let me finish then with a generalization of this idea, which we call BPS without BPS. One can take that vacuum, the 2A vacuum, and add an extra dimension to make it an 11-dimensional vacuum. Now, that 11-dimensional vacuum, ADS5 cross CP2 cross T2, is in fact just the near horizon limit of a more general solution of 11-dimensional supergravity. And this is, of course, as you might expect, just the type 2B 3 brain that we started with. So we have a field configuration that simultaneously solves the field equations of 11-dimensional supergravity and of type 2B supergravity. But from the perspective of type 2B, it's a BPS state. It's just the Dirichlet 3 brain. But from the perspective of 11-dimensional supergravity, it has no supersymmetries. So that's the phenomenon of BPS without BPS. Now, the moral we draw from this is that presumably, if we knew what M-theory was, we'd realize that this 11-dimensional configuration really is supersymmetric. And our error is that would be in thinking that the 11-dimensional supergravity incorporates all the features. And here's a good place to finish, therefore, that there's more to M-theory than 11-dimensional supergravity. Thank you.
I'd like to thank the speaker for finishing on time. We have time for roughly one question, if there is one from the audience. The question is about supersingletons in a non-gauge spec supermembrane.
Yes, and in fact there have been some recent papers by the authors I mentioned at the beginning, Renata Kalosh, Paul Townsend, Antoine van Prooyen, and Klaus, and Kumar, and more recently by Seitlin. And is it Seitlin and Klebanov? Anyway, Arkady will no doubt enlighten us. There's some recent papers where they indeed look at the 11-dimensional supermembrane or the ADS5 cross S5 case without doing the gauge fixing. And as you would expect, there's still the OSP 4-8 symmetry, but it's covariant rather than gauge fit.
Okay, I think it's about time to thank the speaker again.